Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much. You are listening to The Tisch with Rabbi Michael Knopf, a JCast Network podcast. For more information about Rabbi Michael Knopf, please visit mikeknopf.com. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts and blogs, please visit jcastnetwork.org.
2,000 years ago, in the year 70 of the Common Era, the Roman army entered Jerusalem and destroyed the city and the temple that was the central locus of Jewish worship in the ancient world. That happened on the ninth day of Av. It was the culmination of a siege and a war that had actually lasted for many months and even years before that. The war itself actually was the result of a Jewish revolt, a Jewish uprising against Rome that lasted for several years, and that's going to be relevant in just a second. But so we still are in mourning over the loss, over the destruction of the temple, but more specifically over the rupture in Jewish life that it represented, the distancing from the ideal state of what it means to be a Jew in the world, but really, in a certain sense, the ideal state of the world was torn in the rabbinic consciousness on Tisha B'Av. And so we mourn that brokenness that we still feel in our world on Tisha B'Av, and really in order to envision what a redeemed and completed and rebuilt world might look like. That's, I think, the ultimate goal of the day. So we were talking earlier today at Shabbat Kiddush that we've been doing, experimenting with what we call Kiddush Q&A. Kiddush is like, you know, a social hour after services on Saturday morning. And we had like a question and answer session. People asked me questions and I attempted to give answers, some of which were good, some of which were bad, many of which were ignored. It's just part of the territory. So it was a really incredible conversation. But one of the questions that was asked was about the relevance of Tisha B'Av to the state of the world, in particular what's happening in Syria, etc. And in the course of that conversation, in the course of that answer, we talked about the role that history plays, that memory plays in the Jewish tradition. And memory is such a central part of what it means to be Jewish, because our feeling is that we can't actually engage in repair, in healing, in recovery, in restoration, without an honest confrontation with our past. Not in a whitewashed confrontation with our past, and not an ignored approach to our past, but a real direct confrontation with our past. So the rabbis of the Talmud reflect on this question of why the temple was destroyed. And they could very easily have said the temple was destroyed because the Roman army marched in and destroyed the temple, and we should hate the Romans therefore. But that's not what they said. They said the following: Mikdash Rishon mipnei Macharav. I'm in the Talmud tractate Yoma, page 9b, if you're keeping score at home. It says, Mikdash Rishon mipnei Macharav. So why was the first temple destroyed in 586 BCE by the Babylonians? Mipnei Shlosha Devari. Okay, it was destroyed for three things. Shayu bo avodah zara, v'gilui arayot, v'shvichut damim. Because there was in Jerusalem, in Jewish society at the time, idolatry, sexual immorality, incest, etc., and bloodshed. There was rampant lawlessness and immorality and spiritual deviation. And then it says, Aval mikdasheni, shehayu oskin b'torah uv mitzvot uv gemilu chasadim, mipnei macharav. But the second temple, the one that was destroyed in 70 of the Common Era, there were people engaged in Torah study at the time and in acts of loving kindness and in acts of piety and worship. They weren't engaged in idolatry and they weren't engaged in bloodshed and incest. So then why was the second temple destroyed? And they say, Mipnei shehaitabo sinat chinam. Because there was in society at that time unfettered hatred. Every person and every group within Jewish society at the time had an axe to grind against somebody else, had enmity that was unchecked, unfettered, maybe even baseless, maybe even unreasonable. And then it says, Lelam decha sheshekula sinat chinam keneged shalosh avirot avodazara gilui arayot v'shvichut damim. To teach you that unfettered hatred is as bad as the three sins that the rabbinic tradition considers the worst things that you can do Jewishly: idolatry, bloodshed, and incest. At the core of the rabbinic conception of Tisha B'Av is a confrontation with the history of that day, the history of that destruction, the history of that devastation, that says this is not a purely military, geopolitical tragedy that happened. This is a moral and spiritual crisis that happened on our account, because of us. We did this to ourselves. And unless we actually confront that history, there can be no restitution, there can be no repair, there can be no ultimate redemption. So we were talking about that today, and then after Shabbat, I went back and I've been reading this extraordinary book by Reverend Ben Campbell called Richmond's Unhealed History, and there's this amazing passage in it that says, "The strangest fact about the downriver slave trade, perhaps, is that it was virtually unknown in Virginia or Richmond history until the last decade of the 20th century. It did not appear in ordinary history books and was not taught in any of the state's required courses in Virginia history. Virtually all the artifacts and locations of the trade itself were buried under parking lots and superhighways. The sale of African Americans as slaves was one of the principal profit-making enterprises in the pre-war economy of Richmond. It represented the largest, latest, and most distinctive involvement of Virginia in the slave system in America in the 19th century. During the half-century of its prominence, an African-American population, equivalent to the entire African-American population of the state, was shipped across the continent from Tidewater, Virginia. There seems some indication that the trade was kept virtually invisible from all but the men who had to know about it, even during the time it was at its greatest level. But it is certainly clear that the trade was made invisible to the next century of Richmonders and Virginians once the city had burned and slavery was abolished. The impact of this buried history is difficult to estimate. Clearly, much of the history was psychologically and emotionally hidden from Richmond when it was actually occurring. Both for those who were traumatized and those profiting from the traumatization, the denial was all but complete. An interstate highway and a parking lot cover the sites, which are buried under 15 to 45 feet of fill and rubble. Their hidden secrets represent effectively the collective psyches of many who inhabit the land. Is it possible for healing to take place? How? What are the mechanisms? To what degree is the current disintegration of metropolitan Richmond due to an unconscious flight from trauma, fear, and guilt? To what extent are the presently depressed citizens of the city the unconscious heirs of the trauma and abuse?" So this is why we invited Reverend Ben Campbell to come and speak to us tonight, because at the core of Tisha B'Av is the message of an honest confrontation with history, from our own failings and our own flaws in our own story, in our own narrative. And the responsibility we have to honestly and directly encounter those rifts and those fractures and those hatreds in order to actually affect healing in our time. We live in a world, as we can see day in and day out, just by watching the news, clicking on whatever websites you click on, whether they're conservative or liberal or somewhere in between, you can see, depending on whatever your perspective is, that we live in a world that's filled with brokenness. In some ways, we may be living in one of the best times in history, but we are certainly left with the scars of the past and brutal conflicts of the present. This is the time to have an honest confrontation with our history. Because if we don't, we can never heal from it. We can never heal from the hatreds that pull at the fabric of our society today and at the fabric of our world. It's true of the Jewish community and Jewish history, and it's true of the collective history that we all share. So I am thrilled to be able to invite Reverend Ben Campbell to join us to share some words and some reflections. And then afterwards, we're going to be able to have a little bit of a Q&A with you. Is that okay? All right, great. Thank you. Do you mind if we leave the recorder on for you?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I didn't wet my pants. I spilled my water.
Thank you. Well, it's a real honor to be here, and I did not know about this holiday. So I get to learn about it, and we were in Rome. When were we in Rome? 10 years ago? 15?
15.
And we saw Titus's arch. Anybody been to Rome? And on Titus's arch are the candelabra, the treasures of the temple. Hadrian, Rome, yeah. Is it Adrian? Yeah, they're up there. It was stunning. Stunning to look at it, still there, from when they were all carted off to the museum. I guess, you know, the British learned the same thing when they did the British Museum and took all of Greece and Egypt into England. But it was a powerful thing to see that. And I was really pleased to hear the Talmudic work on the destruction of the temple and the way in which repeating that sense, that historic event and its spiritual reality then becomes a part of the work that has to be done today. Because that is the work that has to be done today. So I want to talk a little bit about, well, I'll give you a little story of the Jewish community in Richmond first, which I like, so it's kind of fun, because the Jewish community in Richmond has always been kind of a wild card. Until 20, 30 years ago, you either had to be black or white in Richmond. But nobody's quite sure exactly where Jews are. You know, they do their work kind of, they surface and then they disappear, and they do their interesting work in the community. So I discovered this wonderful story of Richard Forrester. Do you know the story of Richard? Okay, Richard was a boy. I'd say he was 11 maybe, at the beginning of the late unpleasantness. You know, that's the war between the states. Civil War, some Yankees call it. It was 1860. Richard was half Jewish and half black. And his dad, who was the Jew, was one of the wealthiest people in town. But of course, his wealth didn't kind of exactly get into the mainstream of things. And Richard was light enough so that he passed and was a page in the General Assembly. Can you believe it? In 1860. So 1861, you know, Virginia's had this convention going on for 3 months where they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to secede. They actually didn't want to. And the Abraham Lincoln, the Yankees get involved with a little bit of a problem with Fort Sumter down in South Carolina, and Abraham Lincoln calls on the Virginians to go help fight for Fort Sumter on behalf of the Union, and that swings the vote. Virginia secedes, and the 40% of the General Assembly, which it was before that Fort Sumter event, immediately pulls the American flag down from the Capitol building and throws it on a rubbish heap. And Richard Forrester sees it and goes and gets it, puts it inside his shirt, goes to his home and puts it under his mattress. This gives me chills, because if they'd caught him, that would have been it. And 4 years later, when after the burning of Petersburg, after the evacuation of Petersburg, the Yankees are invited into town to stop the fire that my ancestors lit here in order to make sure the Yankees couldn't get anything like ammunition. So they blew up the ammunition warehouse, or whiskey, so they burned the whiskey warehouse and everybody was drinking it in the street. That was a pretty ignominious fall to the Confederacy. Richard goes and gets his flag, comes out, and the morning of the fire, just before Abraham Lincoln comes to town, Richard goes to the Capitol and puts the American flag back up on the Capitol. I love his story. And I also love the tiny little glimpse of what was going on, you know, racially and culturally within the city that the existence of Richard suggests, which is always there are stories that we don't know, relationships we haven't heard, things that are happening. And sometimes sexual attraction actually makes for good international relationships, you know. It's an interesting piece of history. The temple in my prophetic study of scripture, as we move through the prophetic period, is that it stands ultimately for where everybody in the world finally comes together in the great consummation of humanity. So it starts out, of course, being the representative of the Jewish nation, and all the tribes go up. But ultimately, it stands for our prayer for the world. And I think, ultimately, its prayer always is the prayer to the world, because God is the God of the whole world. And so the prayer is always a prayer of the ultimate unity of humankind and how that comes about, both in terms of present practice and how it comes about in terms of some ultimate settlement of this incredible enterprise we don't know. But that's what the prayer is about. This is about God's family being united. And so it's a fascinating thing. The important thing about true religion, whether it's true Christianity or true Judaism or true Islam, is that true religion moves through to the same place, which is the intention of God for the whole world. So if you're a good Jew, that's what you believe. The more good you are as a Jew, the more you believe that. The craziness that takes, and well, Christianity certainly does plenty of this, I don't know, you all have to speak for Judaism. The craziness of Christianity, which says that the better Christian you are, the more you hate people of other religions, is really bizarre. Because that's not what Jesus said. It has no relationship to his teaching. I think it's pretty clear that he's indiscriminate in his relationship with people. Simply treating each human being that comes to him as a child of God. And that's this fascinating work. Now, this is no joke, folks. I mean, this is actually, if we pray, if we are transformed in our own spirit, if we become real and strong, if we become servants of God, this is what we're made into, as persons who build the world together. It's for real. We may suffer to do that, and probably will. But the suffering is redemptive in the sense of its ultimate healing of humanity. So the idea that the temple in 70 AD and certainly the first temple are destroyed because not simply of some external threat, but because of the moral failure of the nation is a really important idea, and one which we do well to look at. America is a strange place, and it's strange, particularly in its claim to virtue. I mean, has there ever been a nation that claimed more virtue than this one?
Rome,
maybe, right. Well, that's not a good start, you know what I'm saying? So we have this claim to virtue. It's strange, particularly in Richmond, Virginia, where we say all men are created equal, and we have a revolution that puts 50% of the people in freedom and 50% of the people in prison or in slavery, in bondage. And we do that. We don't say it's a half revolution, which in fact it was. We proclaim this virtue. And the question that y'all familiar with Arnold Toynbee, great English historian. Toynbee writes this history of the world and basically tracks the idealism and the vision of various nations and how the failure of their idealism does them in eventually. And that's a secular way of describing what it is we're discussing today. The suggestion of many of the prophets is that, well, I love, y'all forgive me for using, I mean, I'm not trained in Hebrew seminary, I just went to Episcopal seminary, and, you know, they probably don't say the right things about things, but I like the book of Deuteronomy, and because the people writing Deuteronomy are trying to say, we've got to get this society straight if it's going to survive. And they're doing this 30, 40, 20 years before the destruction of the temple. So here's this powerful attempt. The book of the law is found in the temple. It's brought out. And we have these powerful speeches by Moses about what needs to happen for this to be a healthy community again. And how, if we don't build moral health in ourselves, we cannot function. So what happens when you in Virginia, it was never against the law to kill a Native American or an Indian, by the way, up till the American Revolution. That was not murder. Just for the record. For 80 years in Virginia before they changed, we practiced white slavery. Basic fact. Africans weren't being imported significantly till about 1680. In Bacon's Rebellion, in the history of Virginia, a rebellion is a revolution that doesn't succeed, just so you know. So, in Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, at the end of that, when a bunch of white folks who were poor tried to take over the Virginia government and failed, when his army surrendered, it was composed of half bonded black people and half bonded white people, which meant that the people running the state got very frightened very quickly and put in a series of laws called the Virginia Slave Codes, which made very simple but painful distinctions between black and white people and used the word white for the first time. Before that, they referred, I don't think Jews did very well in that particular slave code, by the way. I think they were marginalized in that period pretty significantly. As were Muslims. You pretty much had to be a European, to which they used the word Christian. You know, mea culpa, and then switched it to white. And the problem there was that a bunch of these black folks were getting baptized, and it was really messing up the legal. So they do the slave codes, which are perfected in 1705. and then create this very powerful, racially defined commonwealth, a culture, but it's only commonwealth for half the people. The other half the people are basically poor by mandate. You really can't get any money. You can't own property. You can't marry officially. And that's what the American Revolution did, by the way. In Virginia in 1781, just so we're real clear about this, in Virginia in 1781, George Washington was short of soldiers, and he needed some more people in the Virginia line. So the Virginia General Assembly, meeting in Richmond for the first time, because it had been meeting in Williamsburg, moved up to Richmond, the capital, in 1781. Virginia General Assembly got together and said, we're going to recruit some more Virginians to fight in the army, be a part of the Virginia line, and if they'll fight, we will reward each one of them with 300 acres of land and a black slave. So if you fight for freedom in Virginia, your reward is an enslaved person. That's the hypocrisy on which this commonwealth is built. Richmond burned. Jerusalem was destroyed. And I must say that those two events have stayed very close to me in terms of the prophetic work that was done around Jerusalem and the question. Because interesting, it's not... I mean, the destruction of Richmond is no more about the Yankees than the destruction of Jerusalem was about the Romans. There is something in this, though, that we need to look at. And it certainly is true about Jerusalem and in 70 AD and in 586. What happens is when you have an external power with a lot of money and with a lot of military power, it tends to help in the corruption of your own nation. And as you know, that's the problem of many of our nations in Africa today, is that the money outside is so powerful that a few people inside get it, then they have power over the other people. But what happens with race, religion, and ethnicity in the world is that it gets associated with these power and geography distinctions and gets multiplied. So wherever you see really hefty racial distinctions in the society and the world, you will also see economic distinctions. Somebody will tend to be on top, somebody will be on the bottom. Look at Northern Ireland. I mean, we call that Catholic Protestant. It's also, the Protestants have the money and the Catholics don't. That's a lot of what's going on. So we get the distinctions between people multiplied by economics. So in America and in Richmond, black and white is not primarily or only about color. Black and white's about privilege and about economic status and about opportunity. You know, maybe we've done something in the last 30 years to change some of that, but that's still basically the truth here. So that's the first thing, that we end up with what would be a question of whether or not you and I can reconcile ourselves to each other as a personal relationship, which we might well be able to do, especially if we're both committed to it. But that becomes exacerbated by a structural situation in which the generations of hatred and distinction have been multiplied. So a boy grows up in Whitcomb Court, and you tell him that we don't have racial segregation anymore, and he hasn't seen anybody white except for a policeman, you know, or a school teacher until he's 12, 15, 16. He lives in a city where you can't go outside a certain line because the buses are prohibited from going outside it. And he's in a school that's more segregated than it was 50 years ago. And everybody's poor. And you tell him that we have equality. And, you know, he probably wants to believe it just like everybody else does. But it doesn't feel that way. And we're in a situation in the world, and it's always been true, and if you read the scriptures, you'll see it's been true with that piece of history for as long as we can see, where privilege, politics, and power also affect relationship and the possibility of us coming together in the temple to worship God together, which is the ultimate hope of humanity, a symbol of the way we live together. The second thing that happens that I find really puzzling, and this is in looking at Richmond now in particular, I am, for better or worse, a seventh generation Virginian. I almost got out. My dad, whose family had lived in Lexington since 1780, moved to Arlington. So we were
so close.
I was so close. I even went to St. Albans School in Washington for a while and rode the streetcar into Washington, kind of dabbled in it, but I couldn't help it, and I'm back here. The thing that has happened to us in this time, which is so distressing, the opposite of integration in our time is not segregation, but disintegration. We are living in a city of basically 1 million or 1.2 million. If you count Petersburg and Dinwiddie and Prince George and Colonial Heights, you get up to 1.2, 1.3. But that's basically a relatively small city. In fact, Richmond, Metro Richmond, is the 495th largest city in the world. And
right.
I know there are 500 cities of 1 million or more in the world. We're 495th. But there's a. We were just talking before this. There's a sense of disintegration in the place. In fact, it'll be in tomorrow's paper or Monday's paper. One of the guys at the Times-Dispatch was trying to do a story on the time when the schools were integrated in Richmond fully, which was 1970, and 71, when we finally had to give up on the fiction of crosstown busing and, a freedom of choice where a few folks would go to a school other than the one they'd been assigned, but we were actually still maintaining a double system. And we were forced by the course to give up on that. And we were discussing that time and watching what happens. And what happens is the desire desire to finally renounce 370 years of deliberate racism. And when I say racism, I'm not just talking about personal prejudice. I'm talking about assigned privilege. The desire to renounce that basically was overcome by other things. And on the ground, it's the discrimination is very, very difficult today. In some ways, it would be easier if we said, black people can do this and white people can do this, which is what, our ancestors did. But we don't say that. I work with the two greatest artifacts of racial segregation in Richmond today and of racial discrimination. One is I'm working with a bunch of people who want us to have a regional public transportation system. The effective city of Richmond is 1,200 square miles. The thing that Virginia calls a city is 62 square miles. That's 5% of the effective city. which has a beltway around it, so you know what it is. I mean, we all know what it is. Richmond, Hanover, and Ryko. The major impact of the decisions in 1950 to 1970, which is when Richmond got set in its present state, was to stop the public transportation of the county lines. That's a state law. Now, of course, they didn't. It has nothing to do with race, you understand. It's hard to nail this stuff because it is so effectively done in our time. But, you know, it looks like a dog, it smells like a dog, it walks like a dog, it talks like a dog. I think it must be a dog, is what I'm thinking. So, what I can say is that 80% of the jobs in metropolitan Richmond are outside the bus lines. I was in Churchill on Wednesday night with a bunch of people talking about the whole bunch of black folks, mostly from Churchill, talking about fear of police, Black Lives Matter, this kind of stuff. And, you know, funny, this is a panel of six guys, and I was the white person on the panel. They asked each of us to name why we were on the panel, and I said, I'm here because they needed a white person on the panel. But I said, I've got an answer to a question that nobody asked. Because the other thing I work with is Armstrong High School. I said, part of what's going on in Whitcomb Court, where I also go, and Fairfield Court, and Creighton Court, five public housing projects surrounding Armstrong High School, part of what's going on there is a sense of hopelessness that is overwhelming. And every boy that you get on a bus going out to do a part-time job somewhere is finding a life that he never would have had. You're actually saving his life. That bus ticket saves his life. It is that significant what happens, because we have created this society that is basically fragmented. We don't even know one another anymore. And that's the puzzling thing about living in the South, if you live in the South. You know, one of the strange things about living in the South, which is still somewhat true in Richmond, more than it is in a lot of other places, is we actually knew each other. I mean, we were caught in a net and a web of discrimination and of strangeness, but we actually knew each other's names. And if we were really going to tell the truth, we were kin to each other, a lot of us. But what's going on right now is a strange thing, and I actually think public transportation has a very mystical quality to it. Because we basically get in capsules called automobiles, and we move around through the society without really having any contact. I mean, it's an amazing thing what we've done. We get afraid. About 10 years ago, the Chamber did a study of Richmond and three cities of what they thought were comparable social realities and economic realities in the South. I think Memphis, maybe Louisville. It was that type of thing. It was middle-sized cities. And they asked the citizens how they felt about the center city. And fear of crime. Of the four cities, Richmond had by far the lowest crime rate. And of the four cities, the citizens of metropolitan Richmond were the most afraid. Now, I moved to Churchill in 1970. There weren't a whole lot of people up there who looked like me in 1970, and I was afraid. I wouldn't admit it, because I was a very well-trained liberal priest. But after some black folks taught me what I needed to be afraid of and what I didn't need to be afraid of, things got better. But basically, as you know, what happens to break down fear is relationship. That's personal relationship. But when we're talking about white people and black people, we're also talking about coming to understand, and people, I think this is probably where the Jewish community has some wisdom that run-of-the-mill European white people don't have, that there are things that folks experience that you don't know anything about. Just because you can get along with somebody else doesn't mean that you know what it is they're carrying or what it is they have to live with. And when it comes to white and black people in Richmond, that's really true. It's still pretty rough here. My question to you, and I think it's probably the spiritual question of this holiday, as I understand it, is what stops us from just coasting into oblivion? What stops us from passivity that ultimately ends up in destruction? What stops us from drifting apart in such a way that things are never made right? What stops us from actually believing in justice and trying to see that it's made clear? You know, we quote Micah all the time. You know, what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. We quote Amos, we quote Isaiah. And Jesus quotes these people all the time because that's the way he was talking. That's what he was seeing. At what is it that stops us from passivity, which makes us, what is it that understands that the discrimination and the disintegration within which we live today is at least partly deliberate, at least allowing it to continue as deliberate, and that it takes deliberate action to change it? And that's hard. I mean, what is it? I mean, out of the 500 largest cities in the world, I think we have the smallest footprint of public transportation in the world. I don't know any other city of a million that has only 5% of its territory with effective public transportation. It's not true in the third world. It's not true in any poor country. And it's not true in the cities I know that are our size in America. How could that be? How can you treat that as normal? School test scores are directly related to the income of the children in the school, across the board, throughout the country. We're living in a society that says that the only reason the kids in Armstrong don't get the same test scores as the kids in Deep Run is because the teachers aren't doing a good job. I'm like, really? I mean, where I come from, and I'm not a scientist, I'm just a theologian. We have a little scientific quality. But where I come from, if you have two different situations and you put the same input into each situation, you end up with two different situations. The only way you can have a major impact, the data is, and I know these people love data, the data is it costs 200% to give kids at Armstrong the same shot as kids at a middle-income suburban high school. Because, and I know because I'm working there, it takes that money. Poverty is not the only problem. The problem is we're in a society that's sifting people down. And if you end up in that bottom place, there's a whole lot wrong. And every child needs a tremendous amount of support and work that would not be normal or expected in other situations. And that's just true. And we can either work with it or not. Now, we are tolerating this in a society while we preach virtue. And I'm going to quit here, but I think the question of the destruction of the temple, if I can just kind of put it this way, is a question of truth and falsehood. That is, we say one thing, we do another. We preach one thing, our reality is another. We say this is what it's about, it's not about this. And we allow the kind of sin and the pit of destruction to grow in a way without really naming it. Will we survive it? No. I mean, the nation will not survive this level of destruction. And I think that whether you're talking about Ferguson or whether you're talking about the many of the other situations that we're looking at, the backside of American individualism is crazy people with AK-47s walking into rooms and shooting people. The beauty that has been the miracle of some of the wonderful power of individual development in America is what also means that crazy people get completely isolated, get filled with hatred, make effective contact with no one until they shoot people. And we're seeing that happen. So we're in the middle of this powerful, powerful time. We're in the middle of an election with a lot of rancor and hatred going around. You get to pick your own examples for it. I don't have to give them, and that saves me from letting you know how I really feel about that situation. But you can feel it. You know what's going on. Now let me say a word for people who aren't European Americans or African Americans, just for fun. Richmond is, when I say Richmond, I'm always talking about Metro Richmond because it's a single city economically, but it has this horrible division in it, which was deliberately created to maintain racial distinction. And economic distinctions that you don't know anything about. City of Richmond was in complete bonded debt when it was separated out from Henrico and Chesterfield. So it could not, in fact, keep up its schools. It's got 50 years of deferred capital expenditure because it did not have the capacity to issue bonds. That was done by the General Assembly deliberately in 1971. We're in a situation that you really... The level of stuff that was done deliberately in this town and by the state that is now hidden but is still just pushing up evil on a daily basis is really horrible. So the real question is, well, it comes from who knew Mary Tyler G? Jay, you knew Mary Tyler when she was here in Richmond, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
Did you know Mary Tyler Cheek?
Yeah.
Yeah, you did. Anybody else know her when she was here? Interesting lady, fascinating lady. Her husband was one of the developers of the Virginia Museum, or first president of it or something. And she was an unusual person in Richmond in that she was a liberal white person with money. You can probably count the people who fit that description in Richmond, you know, on the fingers of one hand. If we didn't have any Jews in the town, we wouldn't have anything going. But when you come to white European other types, Christians, gets really wild. So, but Mary Tyler came to me one day. She did a lot of very interesting things in town, especially worked hard on some issues of race in the 70s. And Mary Tyler said, you know... Now, I can't copy her accent, but she went to Vassar.
So she had this kind of, you know, impossible to describe accent. And she said, you know, Richmond, I've been all over the world, and Richmond is the only place I've ever been where when they say it'll never happen, they mean it. You know, she could have been standing in Jerusalem in 588 B.C., I expect, or in 69 of the Common Era to name what's going on here. So I'm one of those really weird people that believes in the resurrection. So I just have to say, what I want you to do is to just put your spirit in the concept of what resurrection means. That is, it is a sense of possibility after death. And it is a sense that the power of God and God's spirit in this world is strong enough and unusual enough and loving enough and pervasive enough and strange enough that it can in fact overcome evil. Not by more evil, but by actual awakening of conscience, bringing of repentance, healing of hearts, awakening of possibility among people, that the power of God is that way, and that's our quest, is to be a part of that. And so I must say that I have this other feeling, which is that the prophecies and ideals that were stated in this place, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, all men, everybody, that those prophecies and ideals, which represent the great prophecies of our religious tradition, are in fact working their way in us just as all the other stuff is working its way in us. And that in some strange way we can be a prophetic possibility for the world rather than an example of how bad it is. It feels that way to me in Richmond. And I would like us to be who we're supposed to be. And I would like us to have I know this is going to sound really radical, but a good bus on Broad Street to Short Pump at the airport, and one that goes out Hull Street all the way out past 288, and one that goes on Jeff Davis Highway from Ashland to Petersburg, and one that goes out Route 163, one that goes out Midlothian Pike to the Watkins Center and out to Mechanicsville. I know that's radical.
Sounds like a great place to start a new business.
But doesn't, you see, the reason I'm putting it this way is that is so simple and obvious and economically viable. And the question is, why is it happening? And I'm wondering what the conversation was like. In Jerusalem. Couldn't we just begin to get this right? I mean, isn't that what they were preaching to us? So here we have this wonderful opportunity in Richmond today where we're no longer just black and white and some few Jews over here and some Greeks over here, but we're actually beginning to be, you know, a world city like every other city. And we have tremendous ethnic diversity in our city today, which presents this other possibility of who we might be. Okay, well, that's enough. It can either be integration or it can be disintegration. It's no longer segregation, but it's de facto segregation by jurisdiction today, by the way, and by economic possibility. That's what I got.
Thanks.
Thank you.
this.
No, well, I'll teach it to you later.
I think.
Do you have a few minutes to take questions?
I've got time.
We could take a few minutes if people want to ask Reverend Campbell a question or two.
Dr. Ibsen,
tell me, what part did C.F. Sowers play in this community in the segregation era?
I do not know.
Well, let me tell you.
Y'all know who that is?
Yeah. The vanilla guy.
Yeah, it's a big. It's one of the largest companies doing spices in the world, actually.
He owned most of it, including the West End. And that's why a lot of our Jewish community were doing labors in church here.
Interesting.
Because we couldn't come west.
So, exclusive use of property. Yeah.
And that's why our school system and everything suffered, because we couldn't catch up. I own the house on Fitzhugh Avenue next to Staple Mills Road, where is the borderline of Richmond and Beckerman. The property was owned by C.F. Sowers. What do you think was in the deed?
I expect it was racial.
No Jews, all blacks. And I've got a codicil. The thing right out here on Monument Avenue, that whole piece.
Yeah, that's Sowers Garden. Yeah, right.
It was his.
Yeah, right.
So that's why this community stayed divided for as long as it did. And the way his mentality was, he taught a good portion of the Christian community, and they didn't get out of it. And our school systems suffered because of it. If we had integrated, if that hadn't been, and if the school, the biblical school system had been integrated years ago, we wouldn't have as much of the problems, because the problems now with the children is not the teachers, it's the parents.
Yeah, I think, and thanks for telling me that. And that has to do, what it does is it puts the Jewish community in an interesting place, because the Jewish community has enough of this direct experience like the African American community has, that it can teach and talk about it out of its own experience. And, Richmond's Jewish community is a very important and prophetic group of people in terms of how this larger city has grown. The problem is the concentration of poverty. You can take 20-30% distressed, low-income kids in a school and often make it work, but when you have 95%, the resources just aren't there. So you can see, for example, in Chesterfield, and not as much in Henrico, which has really gotten segregated in the East, but you can see in Chesterfield some schools where they've been able to do, as you can, in good integrated schools, you can do a good job. Everybody profits. Everybody profits when you have a good integrated school. But concentrate poverty is a rough job.
In the mid-60s, I was on a PTA board, and they were discussing the fact, and Rico County,
yep,
that they had to order school supplies by the month. It was budgeted by the month. And there was talk of going over to a yearly budget. And I said, why were you doing it by month if you could order it in bulk? It's going to be so much better. And they looked at me and said, well, order it by the month, you can just stop and close the schools any time. Stop funding it. No schools.
Yes, sir.
Man.
Yes.
Thank you for your inspiring talk. Huh. As usual. One of my best pastors that I would love to listen to over again. So, I love your...
I think the 20, let's see, Labor Day weekend at St. Paul's.
I love your talk about the intention toward God. I mean, we tend to forget this, even, you know, people who claim to be religious, you know. But I want to ask you about the newcomers, immigrants, mover people move out from out of town, who keep hearing that Richmond is for, you know, for hip, you know, hipsters or for cool people or, you know, great food. How do we get this history relevant to them? How do we get them to think, hey, we gotta move forward, we don't have time to go back, this is in the past? How do we make it alive?
I like the question. No, I think that's a good statement of the issue. I mean, part of what's going on, this is terrifying. I mean, okay, Richmond's trapped in its history. It's not the Civil War history it's trapped in. It's trapped in 350 years of deliberate racist segregation that it can't admit, and it started that way, and it never stopped. But what's interesting is that the Native Americans and even the Africans brought from Africa who were put in these horrible slave ships and brought over and often thrown into fields with people from other countries whose language they didn't speak, but whose only thing they had in common was that they were enslaved persons from the continent of Africa with dark skin. Though both the Indians and the Africans understood what communal life was about, and they created communities. That's something, by the way, that Jews do a much better job of. A lot of it's because of persecution. But then, people from other European countries who... I don't like the word Christian, if you haven't figured that out yet. The reason I don't like it is that it's not an ethnic description. It's a description of the choice of a religion. And so we get in a strange place in that regard. But Europeans who are not Jewish, whose nominal religion is Christian, have invented a level of individualism that probably nobody else in the world has. And so you end up with that winning at this point in history in this country, and it's really terrifying, and it disintegrates us. So we, even this very kind of locked-in city, which is more aware of its of having a history, although it didn't know what its real history was. They didn't tell the real history.
There's a book.
Read it. Read it. That's why I wrote it. Read it and live it, because we do live it. But the even this place is getting to the point that we can't tell our story. And it's terrifying. On the other hand, I will say that where do we go? Quirk Hotel, as we had yesterday. Who's been to Quirk?
Yeah.
All right. If you've not been to Quirk and you want to see what it is to be a millennial, go to Quirk. So there is some interesting stuff going on in this current millennial generation in terms of relationship and curiosity and interest in the community as a whole. And I think it needs to grow and get deeper. But I think that there's some possibilities that we don't know yet. I've got to ask folks how to do it. I don't know how. I think you and I both were moving as hard as we can. Yeah.
I moved to Churchill in 89, and I lived in the far west end, said I've never lived on Churchill, not because of anything racial, because of the crime. So, you know, people talk and everything. Mm-hmm. So I did, it's my first house, I'm still there, and some of the homes have the original Star of David on the plate facade, but the people there are very, on our street, they're very, we have people from other countries now, Brazil, Switzerland, Germany, and it's a mixture. I can see a change.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and then
what
I...
What street are you...
30, Mark 35th. Cora Davis lived a couple streets over, right. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And just, the people have really come together, and I would have been jogging several years ago on Halloween. I turned the front porch light off, and I was in the kitchen reading the mail under the stove lamp, and a brick came through. Somebody threw a brick, and there was a note attached to the brick on the front porch saying, "You're not welcome here. Leave the community." Oh. Well, that evening, I was had worked at University Park, and I had a private nursing patient. I came home late in the evening, and there was a pile of glass right on the front porch. I thought, that's strange. I didn't clean it up. The police had been there. You know, I answered their questions. And so the next-door neighbor, Afro-American, had replaced the store windows in their home and had put the glass that he had saved, the storm window, and on the front, in the middle window. And they said, please don't leave the community. And so I've experienced a sense of love and care for each other. And the neighbor, then he died about 3 years ago, and I just gotten home from the gym. His wife was just coming home from the beauty parlor, and she just found her. You know, so I was there for her, but we're there for each other. And then a lady that lives down on the corner worked for Bishop Russell. She has, Bishop Sullivan. So she has his dog. And so we care about each other, and I've experienced a sense of care, love, and concern for the people on this street. And I know where they worship. You know, I know we get involved with them a little bit. When the lights were out for several days, what year was it? I don't know, a couple of years.
Yeah.
People got together on the sidewalk, and you had cookout, get food out so it doesn't spoil and share with each other. And that's just the type of community I've experienced in Church Hill. And I was like the first, I was a pioneer, kind of the first Caucasian on that street for like maybe 50 years, because it had changed.
Right, so, it went back and forth.
Yeah, so now it's changing back, and you have multicultural, and you need to talk about positive things instead of reinforcing the negative things. I just wanted to give you some positive.
No, so that's a beautiful story of the power of God's redemption in personal relationship. That's what it is. It is incredible. It is foundational to who we are as people. And we have to know it. We have to claim it. We also have to claim the fact that this thing has been structured badly and that we need prophetic work right now to change it. We need to kind of find in some way to be active to help some stuff change, because it's not right. And people in this state lie about what they're doing, and they create these situations which are deliberately discriminatory, or their fathers and mothers created them, and they don't even know that happened. But they're living them, and they don't change it. And we're living in that right now, in a situation where we've got some stuff we have to work with. I like the bus thing, because you can do that without changing the jurisdictional lines, and I don't think we can change them. But I know that 100 lives will be saved the first time we have those buses, in the first year, for people with dead jobs who haven't got it.
In January, I think, after one of the snows that we had this past winter, we were at Regency Square walking. When we went in, there was a black woman standing outside. We went in and we walked and we had dinner at Chick-fil-A, and we came back out. She had moved just inside the door, but she was still there. And I think we spoke to her on the way in and spoke to her on the way out and asked if she had arrived home. Well, she had been at work all day, had gotten a ride to Regency because the bus route was altered, but the bus was supposed to come to Regency. She had been waiting all of that time for a bus to come. We went home, and then we came back, and she was came back, and she was still there. So we drove her to the East End, which was where she lived. She had a car, but didn't have money for the repair that the car needed. She had children who were in school, middle school and high school. She was really upset because she didn't have money to give us for gas, which we were not.
Right, but she,
she, you know, she, she was caught in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We found out that the bus had been canceled because of the weather. She had no way of knowing.
Well, that bus also doesn't run on weekends, so if you want to have a job at Regency, then you have to work on weekends. You're out of luck. Thank you for telling that story, because that's directly what we're dealing with. What we don't know about in the society, because we don't know about it, is that the bottom 30 or 35% of society is having a hard time. And this isn't the folks that you're going to put up in the Caritas thing. It's not the desperately poor. It's folks who are living on $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a year.
If they can
get a job. I work at Armstrong, I've told you, with the kids there. The average household income of these children is $13,000. 25% of the population is nominally homeless, meaning they're not in a shelter, but they're in somebody else's house or at man's house or moving back and forth. And this is what this level of society is functioning at. And I work with this leadership program of kids, and we had 24 of them there one day, juniors and seniors, great kids in Armstrong. And I, just for fun, I said, I guess everybody here was a high school student at one point, right? I said, how many of y'all have driver's licenses? Juniors and seniors in high school. 24 kids. Want to guess?
Two. One.
Yeah. Why?
No car.
No car in the house. Or if there was, it was being used by somebody to get there. And, by the way, driver training, which is required, costs $200, $300, $400.
And, oh, by the way, 2 years from then, they'll need a driver's license to be able to vote.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, it's time to speak for the right and to do the right, and we have to. And I was looking at your website, so, and I like the idea of prayer, spiritual work, to make us people who are able to be responsive to God's desire for the healing of the community. And for the bringing of justice and truth. And I don't think we can do that without doing our own personal work, because it's hard. And so I like that you're doing that and appreciate the fact that that prayer is happening here.
Okay. I was really inspired by what you said about resurrection. We have, as you know, that concept, you know, is deeply rooted in the Jewish tradition too. Three times a day, we bless God as Mechaye HaMeitim, the giver of life to the dead. Mm-hmm. Because that's, and the essence of that belief is central to the Jewish consciousness, mm-hmm. right? That what feels to be impossible through God's Spirit can indeed be possible, right? So we come together today to mourn the destruction of Jerusalem, but yet throughout our liturgy we say Yerushalayim ircha berachamim tashuv v'tishkom betocha kasher dibarta, right? That Jerusalem, your city, will be returned, restored, and the key word in there is berachamim, with love, with compassion, right? With through those concerted acts of integration and togetherness, and that's the only way. And I just want to say, I want to point out, not for nothing, and I don't want it to be lost on people here, that this sort of like, you know, little local Jewish shtetl of this unknown Jewish holiday, I think brought incredible integration, not full integration, but a model for what's possible. We have Christians and Jews and Muslims and clergy of all different denominations. People need to meet Rabbi Patrick, the new spiritual advisor of Bone Kodesh, replacing our friend Ben Romer of blessed memory. Rabbi Creditor has been for over 20 years involved in the religious integration of Richmond and working for justice within Richmond. So that spirit is present. And it is possible, and so we're so deeply appreciative of you reminding us of that responsibility and that possibility, and I'm hopeful that your words inspired each and every one of us to be involved in that work. I mentioned this morning that in our tradition, we say we're talking about the power of words, and in the Mishnah it says, Emor me'at ve'aseh harbeh. Speak a little bit and do a lot. And so we hope that that however much we speak tonight, our actions will speak a lot louder.